Since the advent of modern rock climbing in the 1970s and the effort to grade harder and harder routes, falling actually has become an expected part of the activity. But for a handful of climbers, climbing without ropes or free soloing has become the next great challenge. Peter Croft is universally regarded within the climbing world for his long free solos in Yosemite. In 1987, he was the first to free solo the Yosemite, what they call crack masterpieces, Estrumen and the Rostrum, over 2,000 feet of vertical, insecure cracks in the face of El Capitan in only a few hours. But what is it that would make somebody let go of the safety of ropes? Is it another example of extreme risk-taking, suicidal behavior, or is something more born out of a long tradition of self-reliance and skill in climbing? Well, Peter Croft joins us from his home in Bishop, California. Welcome.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So do you have a do-or-die mentality? I mean, is this a death wish?
No. No, I definitely don't like being scared.
You don't like being scared?
No, absolutely not. So, for instance, you know, speaking about soloing, whenever I've gone for something I consider to be, you know, a big challenge as far as soloing goes, I whip myself into shape so that I don't get tired anywhere on the climb itself. And I would actually consider it a failure if I was tired by the time I got to the top. So I stack the odds heavily in my favor.
So let me get this straight. You don't use pitons, you don't use ropes, there's no bolts in the wall. It's you and the wall.
Yeah. It's, you know, basically the same sort of scenario as like a squirrel or a lizard crawling up the rock. It's just about as natural as that. I do use clothes, though.
So nothing that, I'm just boggling because I did a bit of climbing in my early years and, well, it used to scare the shit out of me, to be honest. And that was, you know, with a bit more accoutrements than you're talking about. And you're talking about, we should just describe the classification of climbs here. You're talking about what they call diff, V-diff, difficult, very difficult, and extreme.
There's various grading systems in England. In Britain, it's quite different than it is in the States and Canada. Basically, the climbs that we're talking about in British terms would be considered extreme. In the States, they use numbers, which I don't think they're quite as romantic as using words, but
But they do equate to brown trousers and bicycle clips, essentially. Let's enter our imaginations and describe an extreme slope to us. And what it looks like when you're close to it. And just take us up one. Give us a picture.
Well, I guess part of it is, you know, if you can just imagine a side of a skyscraper without the windows. I think probably a lot of people have seen big cliffs. And it just looks like a blank wall. And I certainly remember the first time I saw pictures of people up on big walls, it looked like a absolutely smooth sheet of Teflon or something. And, became more involved in climbing, I realized it isn't quite that smooth, that there is cracks and corners and edges that you can grab onto. But no matter what, the bigger, more serious climbs that I've soloed, when I get up to the base, I can't really see very far ahead. And so I check it out as I'm approaching it. Because it's so steep, when you're at the base, you can't really look very far ahead. And so you have to check it out as you're approaching it so you can see where you're going to go. I think climbing
Slow down, Peter, because we just got to get this right. Because you're on a slope. Some of the slopes that you've climbed have never been climbed before, right?
But a lot of the times people have climbed the routes with ropes. But there also has been times where I've gone to big cliffs where nobody's climbed it at all. Nobody's ever even seen the cliffs. So I've done different types of things. The climbs that you mentioned. Asterman and the Rostrum in Yosemite. People had climbed those before, but nobody had done them without ropes.
But I think we've still got to get to this wall and what it's like, because if you're climbing up even something that, you know, again, British or Australian terms you call a diff, there are cracks. There are things that are reasonably, it's hard, but you can see something to cling on to. The nature of an extreme or a beyond cliff is that it's not at all apparent where your hand is going to go next. And you're climbing up something, and as you say, you've only got near vision. You've only got a vague idea what's beyond the next piece that you're going to do. Have you ever got stuck?
I think a lot of it is you get to that point. I mean, okay, I think for starters, it's important to know that for the first 5 or 6 years that I climbed, I climbed tons, but I always used a rope. And then I just got to a point where I realized I could do a lot more climbing without a rope. So I didn't just sort of jump into it with, you know, not using a rope from the beginning. But so what that meant was I climbed so much that much of my climbing was no longer about thinking about what I had to do, but it was pure instinct. And it really sort of becomes more of, instead of a comparison with something that is clearly thought out and analyzed and figured out and planned out, it's more like an animal, how it responds to its environment, whether it's a bird in the air or a lizard on
a cliff. So you're in
the zone. But if you think about doing things in the most effective way, whether you're playing soccer or tennis, whatever you're doing, if you have to think about what you're doing, it becomes so much more difficult and more strenuous. If everything is done on instinct, it becomes more of a rhythm. And I think that's one of the things where the actual, not just sort of the nuts and bolts of it, but the appeal of it, you know, people talk about the runner's high, about how, you know, you get into that rhythm and the rhythm of it all becomes almost like a drug. And how you're not stopping to tie in and clip in and deal with all the technicalities and dealing with a partner, that kind of rhythm comes not just on a flat road, but on a vertical or overhanging cliff with nobody else around, and in about the most spectacular setting that I could imagine.
So you're arguing that the accoutrements of traditional climbing make you think too much? I'll give you time to think.
It sounds flippant, but in a way they're kind of distractions. If you could think of, you know, the ideal of being able to feel like, I don't have to worry about falling. I can just go. I don't have to worry that, okay, how far is it since my last piece of gear that I clipped my rope into, or how much rope do I have left, or what's going on with my climbing partner. If it's purely just the movement itself, if you can separate yourself from the fear, it's about the closest thing to the dream that a lot of us have when we're little kids, and that is the dream of flying.
You've argued that people think they're safe with ropes when they're really not.
No. I mean, you can definitely make yourself safe with ropes, and certainly the potential for danger without a rope is certainly there. But I think a lot of times people do assume that simply because the rope is tied to them that they're necessarily safe, and it's only if the whole system is rigged up so that if you fall, you will be stopped in the right amount of time. But as far as soloing goes, one of the safety factors of soloing is that you know that it's nothing else but your toes and fingers.
So tell us the difference between on-sighting and red pointing.
Well, red pointing is when it's a choreographed dance. And it's a very different thing.
You know where you're going because somebody's written up the route.
Yeah, but also you've practiced it. The idea of red pointing is that you've choreographed the whole thing. So even though somebody else is down the route, well, maybe you're a shorter person, so you have to figure out your own way. But you've figured it all out, and so now you know exactly, you know, in all the difficult places, you know exactly what to do, where to put your fingers, where to put your toes, in what sequence. But when you do things,
so it's a planned climb.
Yeah, it is a choreographed dance in a way. But when you do things on site, and certainly at its best, It's when you're going on instinct and your instinct is spot on. And that is, it's far more magical than anything you can have with a choreographed situation.
Tell me about a time when your instincts let you down.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's good about climbing as compared to organized competition is you pick your moment. And so I've chickened out lots of times. And so a lot of times where it's let me down, I've understood that it's let me down early on. I mean, it is, you know, a very unforgiving environment where if it really does let you down big time, you know, you simply won't be able to pick up the phone and talk to somebody.
There's a big implication in chickening out, because you're chickening out on an extreme slope and you haven't got ropes, and coming down is actually harder than going up sometimes.
Not necessarily. See, again, going back to how I said that, you know, I would prepare in such a way that on all the hardest solos I've ever done, I've never been tired when I've gotten to the top, because I've prepared in such a way. But part of that preparation is going to smaller cliffs and climbing up difficult routes and then climbing back down them without a rope. In other words, practicing the whole up and down so that I have an escape hatch, so that I can, you know, if I need to chicken out, and I say chickening out, and that's generally thought of as like a negative.
A prudent retreat, some people would call it.
I don't see it as a negative thing. I'm fine with the term chickening out or retreating or, you know, running away to fight another day, however it is. But to me, if you aren't good at chickening out, then you should never solo.
You've got some stories about coming off high climbs.
Oh, I remember one time in Yosemite, I was on a climb that's about maybe meters. That would be maybe 250 meters, something. And I got to within the last 2 meters of the top. And a thunderstorm hit, and it just started dumping rain. And I had to just climb back down. And not only did I have to climb back down as the water was approaching, but I had to climb faster and faster because the water started coming faster and faster. And, you know, trying to keep it under control.
I'm in a cold sweat just doing this interview, I have to tell you, Peter.
But on smaller cliffs, I had practiced this type of thing so that climbing down wasn't some kind of unknown, scary thing. It was kind of just, it was part of it. It was, I climb up a pitch, I climb down a pitch. So I felt not like it was some desperate thing where I was half slipping and sliding and ready to pitch off, but more like just, okay, climb faster. Do this, do that, make it happen. To kind of launch into the world of free soloing without thinking about what happens when things go wrong would be worse than foolish. Because, you know, if you do it long enough, things will go wrong. Holds will break off. Weather will come in. Animals will attack. And I've had falcons and things attacking me on cliffs and pinned down.
And what did you do about them?
To a certain, you know, if the birds are aggressive enough, sometimes you just have to hunker down and wait until they go away. But one time in Yosemite, I had a peregrine falcon, which are basically the fastest birds on the planet, dive bombing me because I guess I was near its nest.
Mm.
And every time I tried to move, it headed for my, it dove down on my head, and I found some rocks. You know, orange-sized rocks, and I would toss them at the bird. The bird would kind of back up in midair and then dive down after the rock, catch up to the rock, and see that it wasn't like an animal for it to grab hold of, come back up and start dive-bombing me again. And I did this a few times, and finally I faked it out one time and kind of bolted the last bit of the climb to get up to the top and escape. Like I say, you do it long enough, and you have to understand at times you will have to back off it. At times, even regardless of the difficulty of the climb, you'll have to take extreme action.
And you have to do things like, I know with all the technical stuff, but I am fascinated. You will have to have times done overhangs where you've got to reach around the overhang and you do not know what's on the other side, and it's an act of faith that you're going to find something that you can reach your hand on to pull yourself out of the overhang.
Yes, but part of that is thinking, okay, if I can't find anything, you know, I'll try it for a while, but if I really can't find anything, I'll climb back down. And I've been on, you know, most of the way up, you know, routes that are hundreds of meters long, and got to a point where, for whatever reason, maybe the weather's coming in, or I'm not quite sure I can trust a flake because I think it might break off, and I simply climb back down to the ground.
And it's, and I suppose that's the self-preservation, is knowing when to give up and not being proud about it.
Yeah, yeah, and taking your ego out of it. You know, in so much of sport, and that includes climbing, when you're in a situation where you can't afford to fall off, you can also afford, what that also means is you can afford to be competitive. You can afford your ego to be clearly present. But in a soloing situation, your ego has to be taken out of it. And I think one of the things that really appeals to me is it forces yourself to be really honest with yourself. And because of that, you find out who you really are and what you're all about. Because if you try to kid yourself, it becomes extremely dangerous.
Well, just a little bit more about who you're about and the environment. When you first went to Yosemite, you're a British Columbian originally, you're a Canadian.
Yeah.
And now live in California. But when you first went to Yosemite, what's called the deep ecology movement, almost radical environmentalism was beginning.
Was
that the context in which you started? It was a sort of naturalistic feel to climbing, or it was just simply the challenge of free soloing?
If you want the honest answer,
no.
You don't want the honest answer?
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I was anticipating your answer, but carry on.
When I first got into soloing, I was climbing sometimes down Yosemite, mostly up in Canada. And I got to a certain point where, you know, mid-afternoon, my friends, you know, wanted to basically head to the bakery, you know, basically get stoned and then go to the bakery. And I wanted to keep climbing.
In Scotland, it was a pub.
Okay. There was a bit of that too, but no matter what, it kind of mid afternoon, it was kind of like, okay, it's time to, you know, have a little bit of partying and then go to the bakery and have some donuts. And I just realized, you know, it's not like I didn't want to do that, but I wasn't ready to stop just then. And so I took off to the cliffs and went and did some incredibly easy, you know, as far as what my upper grade was. They were very easy climbs. But it just shocked me how much climbing I could do by myself just by toning down the difficulty. And so for the first few years, the difficulty of my soloing was very low level, but I loved the movement. It really wasn't about trying to do anything challenging or trying to impress anybody. It was purely about the movement, and I was shocked that just as my friends headed for the bakery, I spent maybe, you know, 3 or 4 hours and just did hundreds of meters of rock climbing, and I just thought, I've just discovered the greatest thing. And then I did more of it in Canada, and then I took it down into Yosemite and other places as well.
So are you the vertical equivalent of a surfing bum? I mean, this is your life?
Yeah, I think that's it. That's a really good analogy, a really good comparison. When I was a kid, I grew up in Canada, and most of my friends were into hockey, and I wanted to fit in, and so I tried hockey, and I was terrible at it, and I really didn't enjoy it, and I was a terrible skater, and my ankles were weak, and I was just...
This is like a Brazilian not liking football.
You know, I didn't really like the competitive team sports where there was a lot of rules saying, you know, when you could play or how you could play or what position. I just always felt like I was an outsider. And then the very first moment I touched rock, it was the first time in my life that I knew what I wanted to be. I had always been dabbling in things my whole life, and then finally it was like the biggest light bulb going on over my head.
So where did your income come from?
Nowadays it comes basically from climbing. I do some writing. I work with a number of outdoor companies like the North Face and Metolius.
So sponsorship and so on, yeah.
It's sponsorship, but, you know, I go and give talks for them. I help with developing, you know, new products, and, you know, rucksacks and climbing shoes and things like that. And so all of my income comes in various ways through the climbing.
So taking the vertical surfing bum analogy or metaphor a little bit further, you know, surfing traditionally for many years was young guys. Is this a young guy's sport, or are there many women in it?
There's increasingly more women coming into it. Initially, it was incredibly rare to see women involved in climbing, but now it's becoming a lot more mainstream. And I think a lot of that is because of the climbing gyms. It's become so much more approachable, whereas before you really had to go out and get dirty and suffer, and you know, some women weren't so happy with the getting scuffed up and getting grubby thing. But you know, women are increasingly
so you can train
going a bit,
in a safe environment. And what about the next generation? I mean, are they trying to beat the old folks like you?
You know, I think the idea of trying to beat the old folks, I think if that's your main angle, I think you're kind of missing the point. I mean, for myself, I remember just, you know, when I was the first number of years I was climbing, basically through all my climbing, I got so much inspiration from the people who came before. And, you know, if you're trying to get ego gratification out of someone who climbed decades before you, then you're missing something. You know, if competition is where you're coming from, you need to be looking at your contemporaries, not somebody who's coming before you.
I think
in any activity, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of people who've come before, and I think and that's how any field of endeavor it really works, you know, whether it's science or athletics or whatever.
And how many of your friends have died doing it?
I have had, basically, I've been very lucky. I've only had, I had like this one good friend, John Backer, who died soloing, and really nobody else was there, so we don't really even know what happened. But compared to Himalayan climbing, people I know who are well into, you know, climbing in the Himalayas and the Karakoram, places like that, who've been doing it for a lot of years, they have scores of friends who have died. And
it's something like a 15% mortality rate there.
Yeah, it's incredibly dangerous. If you actually, you know, it's probably something you could actually Google as far as the danger factor or the mortality factor in various parts of climbing. Himalayan climbing is pretty much the most dangerous type of climbing. Solo rock climbing is way less so, because you can, most of the factors you can control. You certainly can't control all of it, but you're not dealing with, you know, big snow and ice avalanches. But so statistically, the soloing on rock is much safer than mountaineering. And so I've been lucky. As far as actual soloing goes, I really only had one friend die. And it was horrible. And, you know, it was somebody who was close to me. And and his girlfriend is somebody that is a friend of ours still, who still hasn't, you know, overcome that. It's not something you take lightly. It's hard for me to talk for other people, but for myself, it's a very personal thing, and because of that, I think that makes it a lot safer, because I'm not trying to compete with anybody. It's
you and the mountain.
It's really about doing what feels right for me, and as I said right at the very beginning, I do not enjoy being scared. I just love the movement of climbing over steep rock in spectacular places.
Peter Croft, I've stopped sweating. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Okay.
Thanks for joining us. Peter Croft is the core.
All right.
Peter.
Well, it was very nice talking to you, and thanks very much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Peter Croft is the co-author alongside John Long of the Trad Climber's Bible, published by Globe Pickup Press.